When we first heard the bizarre story of Daniel LaPlante, it was hard to believe it could be true. It sounded more like something out of a terrifying horror film or an urban legend. But we promise you, it's all true. The story goes something like this. A teenage girl rejects the town loner. Then she starts experiencing weird phenomena. She's hearing noises in her house, finding messages written on her mirror, and no one but her little sister will believe her, until one day they're forced to believe her. Daniel LaPlante had been living in her walls, watching her every move, but Daniel's reign of terror doesn't end there. If you're not familiar with the case, you're going to want to hear this story. And if you are familiar and have previously listened, we suggest having another listen, this time with the lights down low. We first delivered this story on the 3AM Mystery Club podcast last year, and since it was one of our first and we think best cases to date, we wanted to re-release it for you ahead of October, which we plan to be our most exciting and chilling month yet. The three of us love this time of year, especially Halloween, so we want to go all out for our first full spooky season. What we love most about this case, other than the subject matter, obviously, is our conversation that happens throughout and after I tell the whole story. I managed to shock and scare Derek and Roe, and that's no easy feat. And one of my favorite parts is when Roe reveals a source of terror in her own basement. So join us once again for the chilling story of Daniel LaPlante.
Hello and welcome back to the 3AM Mystery Club podcast. I'm Brandon. I'll be leading the discussion, but with me are my partners in true crime, Ro and Derek. How are you guys doing?
Fantastic.
Just peachy.
Okay, so I've got a chilling story for you guys tonight.
Chill me, Daddy.
I have to warn you that this story is the stuff of which nightmares are made. So hold on tight for the story of Daniel LaPlante. Daniel LaPlante was born in Townsend, Massachusetts in 1970. By all accounts, he had a horrible childhood. His father allegedly physically, emotionally, and sexually abused him on a regular basis as a child. His mother eventually left his father, so he was able to get away from that torment. But his home life didn't really improve. According to many reports, Daniel was sent to a psychiatrist who also allegedly sexually abused him. By the age of 15, Daniel began breaking into homes. Sometimes he'd take things. Sometimes he'd just move things around to confuse and scare the homeowners when they returned. This is the behavior of a future serial killer, is it not?
Yeah. Sounds like it.
Yeah. It's, you know, ransacking. That sounds a little familiar. How it all began for one of our favorites, the Golden State Killer.
And moving things just to scare people sounds like a telltale sign.
Yeah. And in 1986, Daniel began calling the home of Brian Andrews and his two daughters, Annie, aged 15, and Jessica, 8. Now, conflicting reports say that Daniel either cold called the house, thought the number was one of his previous burglary victims and planned to taunt them, or that a friend of Annie's gave him the number. Unfortunately, these lesser known cases often have conflicting information that we've all come to find.
Yep.
And so we have to do our best to just, you know, figure out which one was reported the most.
Even the well-known cases have conflicting information.
Very true. But the important thing to note here is that Annie answered the phone, and Daniel told her that he obtained her number from one of her friends. But that's, of course, not believed to be the case, perhaps. But moving on from that, Daniel became quite interested in Annie and began talking himself up to her. See, Daniel was a loner who had dark hair, dark eyes, bad acne, and could be described as having an average build, if not skinny. but he told Annie that he was a popular and athletic jock at his high school, and he was able to charm her into believing all of it. So this might be the first case of catfishing that I've ever heard of. Like, yeah, like then you cold call somebody and say, hey, you know, I'm hot, you know, and like I never even thought that was a thing, but this guy is.
That takes some major cojones to do that.
Yeah, for sure.
Catfishing in the 80s, calling someone
and saying, right. So after several more calls to Annie, Daniel got up the nerve to ask her out for some ice cream, and she agreed. And since he drastically misrepresented himself to her, when he showed up at her door, she was visually appalled. Uh-oh. She still agreed to go on the date with him, though. She's nicer than me. Anytime I was catfished back in the day, and it happened, by the way, it was a hell no for me. Like one time I actually looked out my window, and when they were coming up the walkway, I was like, nope, I didn't answer the door. I didn't answer my phone. And I was like, sorry, you lied to me. I'm not going to like let you into my house or hang out with you. Like, no way.
But that's probably why you're alive to this day.
Right. Maybe so. But you know, it was 1986 and she was a teenager and she was probably just being nice. But of course, you know, the date didn't go well. One thing that really stuck out was that Annie's mother had died the year before of cancer. And when she told Daniel about it, he became like kind of obsessed with it. And he wanted to know all the details about her death. And that really upset Annie because she was kind of still grieving. And so she reportedly ended the date and refused to accept his offers to walk her home. And the offer of a second date, of course.
Well, I mean, you know, leading with your mom, talking about your date's mom's death, I'm sure that's in the top 10 of things you shouldn't talk about on
your right date. So yeah, so she had learned her lesson fast with that one. So after that is when things take a very unusual turn. So Annie and her sister Jessica, they really missed their mother. So shortly after Annie's disastrous outing with Daniel, the two girls decided to hold a seance to contact their mother. How 1980s is that?
That's fine.
Oh, God.
Like, who didn't play light as a feather, stiff as a board, or try to contact spirits with a Parker's Brother or Ouija board?
But I've never really heard of people, like, trying to contact their mom.
Yeah. Those are some interesting little girls. Of course, when we did it, I mean, we were never successful, at least I wasn't, even though some of us might have pretended to make contact to scare our siblings or friends. But on this occasion, Annie and Jessica believe they had actually made contact. As they were trying to speak to their mother, they began hearing some poundings on the walls. And around that time, their father came home and broke up the seance. When they told him about the sounds they had heard, he didn't believe them. According to the girls, they began hearing the sounds on a regular basis. It sounded like somebody knocking on their walls or their windows. And so they believed that they had truly conjured an evil spirit, not necessarily their mother, but just an evil spirit.
Oh my God, is this guy like living in their attic or something?
I was thinking, is he in the fucking walls? Like,
he's living like a rat in the walls and just beating and scaring the shit out of these kids.
Oh, just you wait.
Oh no, I'm scared already.
There's this made-for-TV movie called Someone is Watching, where this really scary guy lives inside the walls, and that's what I'm thinking of.
Yes, yeah, so after the noises, they start finding messages written on their walls and their mirrors. And then they begin to find items and pieces of furniture moved around. Their father still didn't believe anything was happening other than the girls trying to scare each other or get some attention. The messages on the wall had been written in ketchup, so there was no reason for Brian Andrews to think that could be anyone other than his own children.
Sorry, ketchup.
Yeah, not blood, but ketchup.
Okay, that takes a little bit of the scare factor away.
So he even decided to take them to counseling over it all. But what happens next is right from a horror movie. And again, there are some conflicting stories. So I'm going to tell it the way the Investigation Discovery Channel told the story. One day in December of 1986, the girls found another message written on the walls. This one asked Annie if she would marry them. The two girls were completely freaked out, ran out of the house, went to their neighbor's house, and they called Brian. When he got home, he went to the house to check things out. What he found was someone wearing his wife's wedding dress, a blonde wig with black and white paint on their face, and they were holding an axe. Brian struggled with the figure and was able to get away, and just like that, the intruder had vanished. This time, the girl's dad had to take things seriously. He called the police, and when they checked out the house, they found a crawl space under the stairs that led throughout the house behind the walls.
You've got to be kidding me.
Oh my fucking God.
And hiding in there was Daniel LaPlante. He had been living in their walls, sleeping, eating, and terrorizing the two girls for weeks, maybe longer.
This is terrifying.
Yeah, I have chills just saying it.
Me too, and I really wonder if this movie was based on this.
I'm sure it was.
Wait, where did he use the bathroom without getting caught?
I imagine he would come and go, but they didn't. Those were details that were lacking. I imagine there was probably a lot of gross stuff in there, like, you know, cum rags and all that nasty shit.
He must have excellent bodily function control.
Yeah.
He had to wait till people weren't alert to him.
Yeah. He was probably, you know, going to the bathroom in their own house or pissing in bottles or something, or leaving and coming back. Who knows?
Oh my God. Ugh.
So he was arrested and he was sent to juvenile detention center. But after less than a year, he was released. And then he immediately got back up to his old tricks.
Oh man.
He began breaking into homes once again. He left one of those houses with two guns. One was found by his stepfather a little later. Daniel lied about where he found the gun and didn't mention there was a second. And on November 1st, 1987, he left his house with that gun and headed to the nearby home of Andrew and Priscilla Gustafson. He had previously broken into the home several weeks earlier and decided for some reason to return. This time, while he was still inside, a pregnant Priscilla returned home with her two children, Abigail, 7, and William, 5. Andrew, who had been at work, came home to find that his wife had been raped and shot, and his two children had been drowned in two separate bathtubs.
Holy shit.
It didn't take long for police to suspect Daniel LaPlante was behind these murders. When investigators went to visit Daniel, he fled. And when they caught him, one of Abigail Gustafson's hairs was found on his sock. He was arrested and charged with the murders. At his trial, he was sentenced to 3 consecutive life sentences, which is, you know,
yeah,
is where he belongs. Because, I mean, yeah, and imagine, had he not been caught, like what he would have gone on to do. Like he was literally a mini Golden State Killer. Like he was in training mode to become a fucking monster. Like I can't even imagine what would have happened had he not been caught.
I mean, this really is nightmare fuel. Like you managed to scare me. That's hard.
Right? Like, and I understand why we haven't heard of it because it's scary as hell, and it really does sound like a movie. And
I can't believe he was actually in the walls.
Yeah.
Oh my God.
Boy living in the walls, basically, is what you could call this story.
That's just so fucking creepy.
I've got to look up this movie because it's not very well known, but it's really creepy.
It has to be based on that. But, in 2013, Daniel made news again because he decided to sue the Department of Corrections, claiming that they were keeping him from carrying out his Wiccan rituals behind bars. According to Boston Magazine, in a document filed in the U.S. District Court, LaPlante claimed the DOC has hindered his ability to practice his faith by not allowing him to obtain ritual oils for worship like dragon's blood, black opium, and honeysuckle. In his court complaint, LaPlante lists more than 30 oils he says are essential to practicing his faith during the various cycles of the moon, recognized by Wiccans.
Okay, well, first of all, isn't opium illegal?
Yeah, when I saw black opium, I'm like, is that really like opium, or is it something that I don't know of, like dragon's blood? Like, because dragon's blood's not obviously dragon's blood, so I could have dove into this a little more, but I didn't want to, if I'm being honest. So I was like, what is all this stuff?
Well, I can say just from all of my friends in that community that the ritualistic part of it is important to them, but it's not a requirement. It's more about intention,
yeah,
and your ability to just really sit back and meditate and put your intentions into being. Rituals help and are helpful to focus that energy, but they're not necessary to practicing the faith.
That's what I thought, and I wasn't sure if that was protected as, you know, under like, you know, religious rights and freedoms, and when it comes to things like prisoners and all that, like, is it considered a legitimate religion?
I believe, as far as prisons go, I'm not sure. I do know the United States military recognizes Wicca as a religion, because on your dog tags on the back, it'll say what religion you are if you have a religion. And in the George W. Bush administration, that actually got recognized.
Oh, wow.
As a religion, at least for military purposes. I don't know about prisons, but
I would say probably not, since they always think the whole, you know, Wiccan thing is related to, you know, the cults and all this satanic panic that we talk about in every single episode.
Right, yeah.
Which, you know, is misunderstood, I'm sure, but I don't know a lot about it, but I take your word for it. That's
and if you really got into it, Satanists are actually more community activists, and they actually do way more good than a lot of quote-unquote Christian organizations.
Yeah.
But that's a whole other debate that we won't go into.
Yeah, those things are always all misunderstood.
Yeah, so, but this guy was not misunderstood. He is a fucking psychopath.
Yeah, and he is not doing anything. He's not helping the Wiccan cause by any means by identifying as such.
No, not at all.
So he's also been trying to get a parole hearing because he was convicted at 17. And since then, the Supreme Judicial Court ruled that juveniles cannot be sentenced to life without the possibility of parole. He thinks that new rule should apply to him. But a judge in just 2019 ordered him to serve the maximum number of years under the law. So he won't be eligible for parole until after he's served 45 years. That'll be 2032.
Yeah, I'm going to say based on the severity and heinousness of his crimes, they're going to find every loophole they can to keep him where he needs to be.
Yeah, there is no way I can say this with complete confidence that this guy is reformed. Like, from living in those walls to, you know, drowning two children in a bathtub after raping their mother. No, this guy's a monster, was born to be a monster, wants to be a monster, and would be a monster still if he was out. So yeah, I hope like hell that nobody ever lets this guy out.
Yeah, like if you pray, let's pray that this guy never gets out, because like I said, you managed to terrify me and not much scares me.
Yeah, check your crawl spaces.
Listen, I'm going to tell you a story about the makeup of my house. My house was built in 1945, and it has this old basement. It looks like a dungeon because it's that rough concrete.
Uh-huh.
There is a well in my basement, and you can't see the bottom of it.
Oh my God.
You're kidding.
And it's not covered up. It looks like that movie where that little girl crawls up out of the well.
What about Silence of the Lambs? You know how she's in that well?
Well, it's a lot more narrow than that. And like I said, you can't see the bottom. I'll actually take pictures and post it on the Instagram.
Oh, please. Yes.
it is a source of terror for me, and it like stares at me as we record. Like, I can't even look at it in the corner. It's
oh, because you're in the basement doing this, right?
Yes, it's the only quiet place in my house.
Have you ever thrown a rock or something into the well?
No, because even throwing a rock in it kind of scares me, because I'm like, what if I don't hear it?
What if you wake something up?
Yeah, seriously. And like, it's got a cover on it, but it's not like, I still have nightmares about this well. Like, either something's coming out of it or something's going to fall in it. It's just terrifying.
So I know we're getting off track, but like, why are there wells in homes? Like, were they actually used like for water, gaining water? Like, where did the water come from? Like, groundwater or?
Yeah, it comes from, there's like a spring on our property and it feeds into that well. And I'm sure there was a pump system and pipes, and you could have running water in your house because it was the 40s when this was built.
Okay.
Now it is attached to the outside spigot, so you can use it to like wash your cars and stuff. We don't use it for drinking water or anything. But another interesting fact about my house, it was the first house in the holler with indoor plumbing.
Wow.
But yeah, so the fact that we have that scary thing in my house, and now you're talking about people living in the walls, like, I don't think I'll be able to sleep.
I hope a lot of people feel that way after hearing this.
That was terrifying, and I just can't believe he was actually in the walls.
Yep.
I just want to say, because I mentioned this movie earlier, I found it. It's from 2000. It's called Someone Is Watching. It has Stephanie Powers and Margot Kidder. I actually had a DVD, I remember. But
Of course you did.
Yeah, of course I did. But it's a very scary, weird movie where like a creepy guy lives in the walls.
So there aren't kids in it, but it was probably still based on the idea.
Well, there is a kid in it.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, but I'm thinking it almost has to be at least loosely based on that.
Oh yeah. Whoever wrote the movie has heard that story.
The kid, if I remember correctly, the kid in the movie lives with his mother, who I believe is a single parent, and I think he has like an imaginary friend, or a friend that he claims, or that they think is imaginary, but really is living inside the house.
Oh yeah. That does sound familiar now. Of course, it also reminds me a little bit of like Black Christmas and a few other movies, but
totally like that.
Yeah, but yeah, terrifying, right?
And Margot Kidder, wasn't she in Black Christmas?
Yeah.
Yeah, it was. She was Barb.
So she was in both those movies?
Yeah.
I'm going to have to watch that now. If I can find it, it's probably going to be hard to find.
Which one? The one I mentioned or Black Christmas?
Oh, the one you mentioned, yeah. I have Black Christmas. Yeah,
I don't know. Yeah, I don't. It felt like a made-for-TV movie, but I'm not sure.
Yeah, it's definitely, I don't think it was a theatrical release.
Even the DVD, like, I remember the DVD looked cheap. Like, it looked like it was not a theatrical release, the artwork. If that makes sense.
Yeah. So, yeah, now that we're going to all have nightmares.
So Brandon's going to end this on a scary note and, you know, leave us all awake for the next 2 or 3 days.
Yes. Try to get some sleep, everybody.